This is We Are What We Overcome. What you're about to hear are the ramblings and reflections of three ordinary people, drawing on their own personal and occasionally professional experiences. These conversations are unprepared, subjective, and should not be taken as medical advice or instruction. Anyone seeking help should always carry out their own research, or better yet, speak to a professional about their circumstances.
Are we going to spend the first half hour of the podcast slagging off other podcasts? We've been doing it for years. Oh, that one. Didn't like their intro music.
We Are What We Overcome on this occasion features musician Matt McGuinness, improviser Nick Tyler, and psychotherapist Wes Evans. Sit back, enjoy, and remember, it's good to talk.
So we've been talking to a radio station, a local radio station that shall not be named in
but
Derby.
You live in Derby, yes, it's probably Radio Derby, isn't it?
But it's not the BBC one, it's the other one. With BBC written on the side. So they wanted us to talk, wanted me to talk on the radio, but I said, oh great, when are we going to talk on the radio? And they said, oh, breakfast on Sunday morning. I said, oh, I was hoping we'd talk on the arts programme that you've got. Oh no, you don't talk about mental health on the arts programme, that's completely and utterly the wrong place for, that's exactly the right place. Anyway, so that brought it home to me. The idea is that you actually talk about mental health when in those places where they don't really want to talk about.
To reset a little bit, yeah. Your lovely spiel about the Fringe, we will get into in a moment. We were going to begin just by saying kind of who we are and why we're doing this podcast.
I think you should go first, actually.
Oh, right. Oh, great. Hi, I'm Nick. I'm an improviser and I work in publishing. I'm here because Matt made me come. To talk about mental health amongst other interesting things.
Do you want to go next?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Wes. I'm a psychotherapist. And this is the first time that I'm meeting both Matt and Nick, and everyone in this room, as we're recording. I live in Lancashire. And so I'm assuming that when you had this idea to start a podcast based on your experiences at Edinburgh, you set to work trying to put it together, and that's... that's pretty much how we got in touch, really. I responded to a social media post.
Yeah, and it shows how professional I am. My idea was to write the actual script or the bits for the show on Messenger on Facebook and send it to you.
Yeah.
But fortunately, Nick put in some sort of document, which is called Coherence. I don't know what that kind of document
Google
that
doc,
is.
Yeah.
Well, and there wasn't that much to and fro on the Messenger thread, to be fair, was there?
No.
There was just a few comments from a few people, and then that was that, but... That feels fitting. And now that I've just heard that you work in publishing, Nick, that explains the obsession with fonts.
Yeah, it does, yeah. Layout is my thing. Mm.
So, it's all making sense. As you sit with a person, you learn so much about them.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
It's my job, actually.
Which kind of brings us to the guy in the middle. So
I'm
who
Matt.
Are you? Who are you? So
I'm Matt, and I'm a musician, and I work in events. I suppose the thing for me of why I'm doing this thing is that besides the fact of being slightly out of sync with reality myself, although I think I'm in a good place at the moment, so that's I don't know if that means that reality's got better or I have, but one or the other, we've met somewhere in the middle. But I remember the first song I wrote about mental health in terms of Frock and Bonnet. I was actually going to see and when we talked before, actually, I don't know whether it was a psychotherapist, a psychoanalyst, a physiotherapist, or whatever it was I went to see. It was one of them. But I wrote a song called Frock and Bonnet, and I performed it in Nottingham. And it was the only song of the show which was, you know, about that, although I guess they probably all are. But it was the only one specifically about mental health. And then afterwards, two blokes came up to chat to me about their mental health issues. And I just thought, that's a bit weird, isn't it? Why are they talking to... some idiot with a guitar when they could quite easily talk to someone who'd spent a number of years at university or college and then a number of other years in practice who actually know what they're talking about, but they'd rather talk to someone who's got an £800 guitar and doesn't know how to play it. You know, it's just strange.
I think that's a common thing.
What, the £800 guitar and you can't play?
Yes, most people I've met have an £800 guitar and also are reluctant to look for professional help.
You got two?
No, I don't have any guitars, I'm entirely amusical. It's just noise to me.
So that's where we were.
So you did the show at the Fringe. Why did you want to do a show at the Fringe? What prompted it?
I've absolutely no idea. I don't know. I just thought it was a good idea. I mean, I think actually it was with my... my friend Dan, and we met some people who've been at the Fringe, who told me how hard it was to do a show at the Fringe. And I just thought, you know, and I think we got told we don't really understand how difficult it is. And anyone who says that to me, I think that's a really stupid thing to say, isn't it? They were right, obviously. But actually, they were slightly wrong, because I think once I'd done the show, we got there at 10 in the morning, driven all the way to Scotland, which you don't know from Derby is about, I don't know, what it is, 6 hours or something, and maybe something like that. And we got there really early and then spent all day, and I thought, this is brilliant, isn't it? And, oh, I don't really know where I'm going around here. And we went through the whole day of all that, and then finding my friend who was with her, who was doing the show as well, and find out where she was. And then I got at 10 at night, and I was thinking, oh, I'll go for a drink. And then I realised the show was in half an hour and I hadn't actually performed yet.
But what did you want the show to be?
You said something about self-help.
Oh, yeah. So I basically just thought I'll chat about where I am and how I got here.
Literally,
yeah. And it was fine, I think. I don't think it was very good, but I got away with it. And I got some nice messages after the second show, you know, from people who'd sent me an email, the next morning after the first show, I got up thinking, that's all right, wasn't it? You know, because it could have been absolutely disastrous.
It could have been like 70% of all the other Fringe shows. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I had 12 people in the audience, I think, on the first night, and I just thought, 12? That's ridiculous. You know, it should have been 50. No one knows me. I've never done this before, but the room should still have been full. That's a kind of arrogant nonsense that goes around your head. But apparently the average show in Edinburgh is like 3 or 4, so that was quite good.
Yeah, you did all right.
Well, there are 6 people in this room in the audience.
Although technically some of them aren't really audience.
Can you not count?
But yeah, one's wearing headphones. Either he's not enjoying the show or he's something to do with technical.
I think you're not taking into account all those people on the next tier at the back.
Oh, of course.
yes, I know.
Didn't look up. So, were you trying to say something? Was it a personal challenge? Did you want something from it?
I just think I did it in the same way that I do everything. If there's an issue, I just talk about it. And to be honest, and that's what I just thought, what's the extreme? I suppose I didn't think this, but I guess it was just what the extreme. So I've always written songs, and then I thought, you know, why don't I just do a show? Why don't I go to Edinburgh? That would be a great idea. I'm not in a really good place at the moment. Why don't I go to a completely different country and in a different city and do something I've never done before, full of loads of other people?
Yeah, put myself under an intense amount of stress. Yeah.
And everyone else, to be honest, I was going to bring the programme tonight.
It sounds like the worst possible idea. if you weren't in a good place, going and insisting on setting up an Edinburgh show that people then come and watch a thing where you have no plan and babble at them about being sad.
I don't know, that's, I kind of admire rough. It, actually.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, it's admirable. Crazy, but...
I think if you look in the programme, look at the titles of the shows, most people are probably doing the same thing that I was. You know?
They may well be. Mm. Now, you mentioned that you were not in a good place when you went up to do it, which somehow prompted it. What was that place?
I sort of hit that sort of brick wall, really, I think. You know, where you just... there's no reason for it. Well, there were a couple of reasons, but no massive reason. But I just... I had no interest in anything, really. I was just... I think the easiest way to describe it for me is that you're actually just existing, aren't you? You just... All you're doing is... you're just getting from one thing to the next. Mm-hmm. You're not actually thinking about some kind of future or tomorrow or something. You're just going through the motions. Do you know, someone said to me, you sound joyless. And I think that's the thing, is it? That's the... You're doing everything else that you would normally do, but without any kind of joy within it whatsoever, which is great for a show in Edinburgh. Here's this show about mental health, depression and suicide. By the way, there's no joy in it.
Well, that's okay. I mean, but that persistence is, that feels like a familiar and fairly normal state. You know, you're not necessarily thinking about the next thing. You are just getting through the next day. I'm sure a lot of us live like that. That sounds very familiar.
But it's also quite stark when you go there, because you go there, don't you, thinking, I'm doing a show, I've never done it before, isn't this really important, whatever else? And you go there and no one, you know, everyone's doing it. And?
Well, yeah, so you go to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, by definition there are a million people doing shows.
Are you always right? It's like that function, isn't it, where people go there for their weddings and you go there and it's the most amazing day of their life. But everyone who's running the function room has done it the week before and it's exactly the same as the week before, except these people are called Dave and Gerald rather than somebody else.
So you feel like a functionary for your own life?
Oh, that's deep.
I think I'm going to get my friend to answer this on my left.
I was just thinking that Nick is sounding more like a psychotherapist so far.
And how does that make you feel?
Well, like... I was thinking that I better not speak up or I'm going to have to start charging by the hour. So then you got onto the idea of creating this podcast.
Yeah, well, then sort of developing the show, and I actually thought about how we're going to promote the show, and then and someone said, "Oh, we should do a podcast." And a couple of friends have been talking about podcasts, and then I thought, actually, the podcast thing itself on its own is brilliant, isn't it? Really good idea, you know. And could we use that as an idea for the same sort of thing? And the whole thing seems to have spiraled. You know, the first two shows have been really popular, and people have been really open. And one of the things that's come through is people just liking the fact that you can openly mention the S word, suicide, and without people diving for cover. And, you know, and I keep saying that thing in the show about, you know, it's about, it's like cancer. You know, they used to talk about cancer 25 years ago. Don't mention cancer because then you'll get cancer, you know. But it's the same thing about mental health, isn't it? You know, don't speak about it. And even though now it's supposed to be a bit more okay to talk, it's still not really, is it? Mm-hmm. I mean, I did that. It's funny, when I did the show in Edinburgh and people had come to the show expecting it because it said on the front of it, mental health, depression, suicide. It was, you know, out there.
I mean, it sounds hugely big.
Maybe that's why I've got 12 people for the show. But then I did some stuff on the high street, you know, on those stages that you have on there, wherever it is.
Oh, the Royal Mile.
Yeah, and I was just doing songs. But then one day I thought, do you know, I'll do a bit of the show. It's right in the middle of Edinburgh. Nice sunny day. I'm going to do a bit of the show. We haven't come that far because it did not go down very well at all.
I think that's interesting. I think one of the reasons the show is successful, I came to the Belper show and it was great, is that you've created a space in which people are ready to listen to you talk about mental health, and which you give them permission to then talk about their own mental health. Mm-hmm. And we don't find that in general society and in places. It's very hard to find an occasion where it doesn't feel like you're imposing on other people. Mm. Yeah, it's a bit like how we start your show. Yeah, oh, how are you? Isn't really an invitation for people to go, oh, I tried to kill myself yesterday. Mm. That's the last thing you want to hear when you say, oh, how are you? What you always go is, oh, great, sweet, let's go and have a drink. Yeah. Yet, no one wants to hear that. Mm.
Yet when I mention what I do, you'd be surprised how the conversations change.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So social situations. Oh, yeah, how are you doing? Yeah, what's your name? Yeah, what do you do? Oh, I'm a psychotherapist. Really? And suddenly the tone changes and people are so surprisingly willing to just immediately spill it out. And I have to kind of contain that. And kind of
like well, a free session.
Yeah, it's your turn at the loo, mate, kind of thing, you know. That literally happens to me sometimes.
So it's like a structural invitation, you know, because you're like, I'm a psychotherapist, therefore.
But I'm a stranger as well. Mm. So there's, you know.
Well, which obviously Matt would be, you know, for his show when people come to you. You're still a stranger.
It's, yeah, you mentioned that a minute ago, didn't you? People just coming up to you and spilling gall.
Just openly telling me everything. But you know,
except with me, there's an expectation to make it better.
I just have
you
to
just
listen.
Walk away.
That's the struggle. That's
yeah. Well, what's it like suddenly being mobbed by people telling you about their mental health problems?
Do you know what? It feels really positive. I don't find it depressing in any shape or form, because it just feels really positive. The fact that they are speaking is great, isn't it? You know, in no way is any solution for anything, but one more conversation with someone, no matter what, is better, isn't it? I think, you know, you've got to be careful where it goes. I wouldn't for 1 minute want to pretend I'm your good self or capable of that, and you know that would be disastrous, but just allowing people to be able to speak is great. It's also a little bit sad as well that it comes to that, you know, that it has to be. I really want to get to the point where people could say about their mental health whenever, and it would just be a 2 minute comment. I think you said the other week to me, it's got to get to the point where it's boring, isn't it, you know?
Oh yeah, that would be amazing. As soon as things are boring, then we can talk about them freely.
Try speaking to 5 people in a row about it. They don't work. No, I'm joking.
How many do you have to speak to in a day?
Well, there is a limit. Because just as you were saying, you know, I don't find it too depressing. Actually, I find it really good that people are talking about it. Yeah. You're right. There is that flip side that it's actually pretty sad. It shows that it's that it's a really common problem. Lots of people are affected by it. But yeah, you've got to take care of yourself. And I have to take care of myself working with that material day in, day out.
What's the limit of how many a day?
This varies depending on your training, your background, your ego. but for me, I wouldn't want to be seeing more than 4 or 5 people.
Crikey, it's a lot.
That is a lot, actually, yeah.
Because I guess, yeah, I mean, you need someone a downtime after each session, not just to make notes for your professional notes. Put your head in your hands and get ready for the next one.
I felt sure that you would bring up notes and fonts again.
Yeah, well, obviously, yeah, handwriting, I can't speak to the font you're using.
For confidentiality purposes, I write all my notes in Winding. but you're right, there is that space necessary because self-care is the old expression, you can't pour from an empty cup kind of thing. You know, you've got to take care of yourself to be able to take care of anybody else. Mm. I access clinical supervision on a regular basis, but I also access my own kind of support for myself. I go to group therapy a few times a year for like a weekend kind of session. But I also run a therapist support group, which is kind of an oxymoron, isn't it? You know, lots of therapists turn up, come through the door, and just be like, "Ah, I can drop the act." You know,
I guess like, that's so revealing of the need that you know, even you know, trained, hardened professional for dealing with mental health problems needs exactly the same support that the people who have mental health problems require, but just don't have.
Well, there's a thing called therapist burnout. You know, if you were seeing too many clients or not taking care of yourself, you've got to question yourself when it gets to the point, are you being too impacted by the material or suddenly not impacted at all? You know, then there's a problem. But I guess what I was getting at is that just that you say people are coming to speak to you illustrates the weight of the problem we have today, you know, in the current world now. Too many people are affected by poor mental health and a lack of support.
It's that, you know, there's a bit in the show, and I've dropped it actually because I just think it doesn't work.
It's really depressing.
No.
This is the perfect time for it.
But,
you know,
but that whole stats about blokes killing themselves, you know, just ridiculous.
And the statistics change actually all the time, but whichever way you look at it, it's 2 minutes.
And someone suggested the other week that what I should do is look at the audience and say, split them up and say there's 60 of them in the room, you know, 10 of.
Yeah. So by definition, 10 people feel this.
But the thing that really is overpowering is the amount of people that come and talk to you that tell you that someone close to them has killed themselves. It's low. I mean, it's not like one person. You know, I don't know what that...
The scale is horrifying. It's like, you know, when you do have frank and honest conversations with your friends and it turns out that everyone's on some kind of antidepressant or anxiety medication and almost everyone's been in some kind of counselling or therapy scenario, you're like, oh my God, we're all screwed. And there's something about that special versus normal thing, yeah, that for a while there's a kind of specialness, oh, I feel very depressed, that's just me. And then you discover that everybody else is also in that state, and yet we don't treat it as a normal thing because it's not that banal, tedious stage yet. It still seems like we're holding these mental health states as being special things that are unique to us. And we'll all have our own special different flavour of it, and we'll have gotten to that point in our own different way.
Are you speaking for yourself now? I've started now, guys.
I heard your tone change.
Yeah.
I think you handed me a box of tissues. Yeah. It was lovely. Yeah, I think so. When I went into... CBT course and then some more serious counselling a few years ago, and I think for me I'd held on to the fact that, you know, that I was kind of felt like kind of broken, like I'd like the phrase slightly broken, because everyone is slightly broken, we're not completely wrecked, some people probably are, and I'd held it in my head as like this is like unique to me somehow, no one else really understands how I feel, and this hurts me and it burns me in different ways, and going in and finding that loads of other people feel kind of the same way was at once really heartening that this is kind of normal and yet robbed me of the specialness of it and of the uniqueness. And I'm not sure if I ever really resolved that in my head, that, you know, it became kind of less important in the grand scheme of things, but it didn't do anything to diminish how I actually felt, which I found deeply frustrating. Mm. It's like, wait, this is normal, but it's still f***ing me up. That's very annoying. Is there not some way for... Surely now that I know that this is normal, I should not be concerned. I found that a tension and a conflict that I don't think I've really resolved in my head.
Well, just the comfort of thinking, well, actually, lots of people feel this way, followed by, I thought that was just my thing, you know.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot about the comfort and normalising being a helpful thing, but not so much of the, I thought this was my special, unique quirk.
Yeah, I only
but actually it makes sense. I get that. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, it was almost had to have that taken away. Because I think once it becomes less special, then it shouldn't be something that you hold on to. It shouldn't matter anymore. It's like that lovely line from The Incredibles, isn't it? What's everyone special? That just means that no one is. And you're like, that kind of burns. Once everyone's got superpowers, it doesn't matter that you've got superpowers anymore. I guess the mental health issues are like the opposite of superpowers.
Oh, The Incredibles.
Yeah,
so widely quoted.
Oh, it's so great for so many things. Never mind, The Mole Man. Yeah, I don't know where it's left me, but it leaves me with that strange sense of specialness being taken away, and how, if it's not special, why should it matter so much? Mm. Surely something that isn't special should just be fine.
And considered that angle, really. But what we are touching upon is this kind of the universalness. I've made up a word there, I'm sure. But
universality.
Oh, thank you. Publishing.
That should be in a large font.
Please don't correct me in public again.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm crying into my drink now.
I'm twitching as I remember earlier experiences. But no, there's something true about that, isn't there? This stuff is universal. You know, we talk about mental health, and I hear a lot of people saying, "Oh, he's got mental health, he has." And we all have mental health.
You should hope so.
You know, and it can be good and bad, and it can fluctuate. And
there's a great guy at Edinburgh. I can't remember his name. Graham was, and he said he was talking about the spectrum. And he said to someone, it got really annoyed to him because he said, "You're on the spectrum as well." The bloke went, "No, I'm not. He says, "That's how a spectrum works, you know." That was Graham Worcester's joke, by the way, not mine. No copyright.
A link shall be posted in the description.
But
we are all affected by this, you know, myself included. I got into this kind of work. I decided I wanted to do this. Not only... That's a quick little thing about my background. I came from a background of working with challenging young people. Fell into it and then did that for about a decade. Realised I didn't want to stay in teaching and start questioning where am I going with all of this. A little bit existential, really. And then I decided, actually, what I want to do is... The common thread was that all of these people I were working with just couldn't understand themselves or handle the way they were feeling. And that's what made me decide to train as a therapist. But actually, when I started my training as a therapist, in Nottingham actually, so not too far away from where we are now, for the first 3 years degree that I did, I learned more about myself than anything else and grew and changed and developed so much, more than I could have ever imagined, actually. Mm. I think... I thought that I was in a better place than I was. Thought I knew more about myself than I actually did. But I feel like I found my calling, so to speak, that this is what I was meant to be doing. Mm. It affects everybody. In fact, there's a thing called the wounded healer. This idea that someone who goes through something will then want to learn how to help others overcome the same. The wounded healer. You could probably look that up, guys.
I'll Google it now.
Yeah.
That's all.
It sounds similar to the idea that you can't understand someone's experience unless you've experienced part of it yourself, which I think is true to a certain extent.
But
taking that too far means that you can't ever get inside anyone else's experience.
I can't relate to every single client and every part of every client's story. But I can sit across from them as a human being and try and be there with them. And that's essentially the biggest part of what it is that I do, is listening and being with a person. But yeah, what we were talking about is that this stuff is universal. the universality of it.
I see the bitterness in your eyes.
I'm a quick learner. Thinking about what we said we wanted to do with this, so we're kind of moving into talking about mental health in general. What do we mean by mental health, and kind of the current picture today? That's what we've just been talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's. I had this thing about, you know, when is being sad, being depressed, you know.
Well, you make a good distinction. So, I mean, I'm a psychotherapist, and I think on your original post asking for people to get involved, you stated psychiatrist. Yeah. And we had a conversation earlier, didn't we? We laughed and said, oh, well, yeah, psychiatrist, psychotherapist.
What's the difference? It's 20 quid an hour.
You promised you wouldn't take the job.
Can we cut that bit out?
I am a psychotherapist, but there are counsellors, there are psychologists, there are psychiatrists, and there are differences in training. But even psychotherapist to psychotherapist, there's a difference in background. I suppose it depends on what you believe, but ultimately I believe we're a product of kind of everything we've ever experienced. And you were asking, am I sad, am I depressed? Where is this line where suddenly we'll say that we have a mental health problem? The medical model would say that there are certain criteria to meet to be able to diagnose someone with a mental health condition. The DSM is the textbook that they use. I disagree with parts of it. But actually, a lot of what I will do sometimes with a person is question this notion of labels. Sometimes a label can be really helpful and give us a language to use, know what it is that we're talking about. But sometimes a label can be really harming and really fixing, kind of put you in one place and, oh, this is what I am, this is all I can ever be. We all experience anxiety. In fact, we need to experience a level of anxiety.
Otherwise, you just don't care enough to do
something.
Yeah,
well, it's probably in primitive terms, it's like an innate warning system or something, isn't it? If it becomes that it affects your day-to-day life and is problematic and gets in the way of everyday functioning, then maybe you need support. I think it's a very individual thing.
Because my lay sort of grasp of the difference between like a normal emotional state and a mental health issue is that a normal emotional state, like happiness, is fine and all. We're all happy and sad at different times in our life. But it becomes a mental health issue when you're happy beyond like your reason for being happy.
So if you're too happy, you're...
Yeah, it's like, what is it you're happy about now? Oh, I'm just really happy about things all the time. Okay, why are you happy about this? Well, I don't know, everyone's dying, but I'm still really happy. You know, it's when that emotion gets out of phase.
Is that what makes you happy? People are really dying.
It's quite funny that you used happy as the... I try to keep this light.
I acknowledge some issues with what I just said. it's that point at which your emotions get out of sync with the reality around you. You know, we become sad when we lose things or things don't go our way. That's fine and normal. It's retaining that sadness when those conditions that should have made you sad are no longer there.
That kind of puts a clock on things, just to play devil's advocate.
Yeah, tell you a little bit.
You know, so, and actually, that you describe it that way, that probably is the way the medical model would say it, you know. Mm. So after a traumatic event, if you are still affected by it 6 weeks afterwards, I'm not sure if it's 6 weeks, but well, then we will classify it as PTSD.
The clock has gone, you should no longer
be affected by this.
Well, I went to see a doctor for the first time, you know. Yeah. I got offered drugs within the first 5 minutes. Mm. So they made that assessment with him. It must have been brilliant.
Well, this is a whole big meaty topic in itself. What do we mean by depression? What do we mean by anxiety? How do we define it? And the current system and what it is like, you know.
But I think
these words are thrown around really quickly. People are offered drugs immediately.
I think no offence to them, is because they have 7 minutes for a patient or something stupid like that, haven't they? So roll in, I'm feeling a bit depressed, some drugs, problem solved.
But it also might be a quick temporary fix until you can access more serious treatment. You know, it's like we need to in some way get you under control now, very briefly, so that nothing bad happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this will sort this for a couple of weeks before you can get into counselling.
Funny you should say that, because I said, well, did you have suicidal thoughts? And I said, yes, I've had some, and I can't sleep. And they said, right, would you like some sleeping tablets? Well, yeah, thanks very much. Mm. But
I would like to sleep. Please give me drugs. Brilliant. That's what I want from a doctor.
That sounds really easy. Was this in the park? By a bit.
Is that lovely parka full of different kinds of bags.
I took notes, and that's exactly what was said verbatim.
But the truth is that, you know, using a simple list of questions, most people use the GAD scale, the general anxiety scale. Or
What's a GAD?
GAD is general anxiety disorder, but the... that's not the GAD scale. It's the PHQ-7 is used to...
That's what you were talking about before.
Yeah. I throw that around all the time.
Yes. I have copies in the corner if you want to see. My point is they use specific forms, specific
I'm
measures.
I'm feeling pretty good, you know. I've got you talking about the PH1 scale on one side, him talking about fonts on the other. I'm feeling quite good in the
You're thinking to yourself, I'm all right, actually. That'll be £50.
Sorry,
pounds. But a person's fate can be measured by answering, you know, 10 questions. Now, on the one hand, very necessary that we have these questions to check out if you're feeling a certain way at a certain time. And medication can be useful to help us get on a certain level, perhaps, by way of then getting further support or getting what you need and stuff. But on the flip side, these terms are thrown around far too easily. And we should be careful with that, I think. That's probably a bit of my own personal gripe with the system.
Mm. That thing you said about form, actually, is important. Me and Nick were talking about it. That was the thing I tried to get across to people about. If you actually go and see someone, don't worry about the first or second session. Saying to people, if you want to go and see someone, go and try and see someone, but don't give up after session one or two. Because the first session is,
just answering all those questions and having them read back to you.
Here's your life in like 15, well, in fact, 5 minutes read to you back by someone who is just doing it really clinically.
Your life on a scale of 1 to 10.
7 years, 7.
You mean if you go and see a counsellor or a therapist or something?
So they have the form and they say, do you feel suicide 1 to 7? Do you do this, do that? And then, can I just go through this form again? So, suicide 7 out of 10. Yeah, I guess so.
But that reflection was really important because you put the number down. I feel like a 6. And it's not until someone reads it back to you, you go, what did you think 6 meant? In your head, it's until you get it read back to you. Like, I don't know, what a 6 is it? A 7? Do I feel sadder than that? Do I feel less sad than a 5? It's part of what makes you think about your own mental health, because it's very hard to think about without extra terminology and without extra forms, because we have no frame for it. It's just the stuff inside of our heads. And since we've acknowledged that we're very bad about talking about it in society in general, until someone presents you with a bunch of questions that do direct you back into thinking about your own brain and what's going on, I think it's likely that a lot of us don't have any fixed concepts. I'm like, I don't feel great.
So those forms were helpful for you?
Yeah, though. I think so. Because saying, you know, I don't feel very good, it must be some kind of nightmare for anyone trying to diagnose it. So how do you feel? No, not great. Oh, brilliant. That tells me everything I need to know.
It's bad for a first.
There's no detail, you know, and it's getting into the detail that will help you get better. And I think a lot of getting better is, kind of as you're saying with your training as a psychotherapist, a lot of it's that self-reflection and the opportunity for self-reflection. You've got to know yourself better. And I think most of the counselling I've done has enabled me to get to know myself better in ways that were very hard to access without being asked quite pointed questions for things that I hadn't thought of considering.
Mm.
It's hard to ask yourself questions. It's easier just to get on with persisting and going back to work the next day.
I always thought that the questionnaire as the first session was probably the worst thing.
Well, I agree, I
don't know the way around.
In my private practice, I don't use those questionnaires. No, I don't.
Can I come and see you?
Yeah, sure.
What do you do instead?
Well, I offer a free consultation. So this is just the way that I work, and a lot don't. And I should also say that this is me working privately as well, as opposed to for an organisation or for the NHS. I have worked in other organisations where we have used types of formal assessment at the beginning of the process. You tend to find, though, that that's more about measuring for the organisation and being able for the organisation to be able to demonstrate their worth at the end of it, which just feels a little bit secondary to me, actually.
40% reduction in sadness feelings.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. So I don't use forms like that. I offer a free consultation, and it's a chance for the person to speak about where they're at, what they think they need, what we might want to do together, for them to meet me, for them to see the office, all those kind of things. And then the work will tend to pan out really quite differently with different people, as you could imagine. I would say that, looking for common threads, the two things I would hope anyone would get from coming into sessions with myself, you've mentioned one, which is an increase in self-awareness. I think the more that
one can learn about themselves, the more they can start to live more choicefully instead of less so. But another one for me is I would hope that someone increases the self-expression, start to maybe say things out loud, to talk about how they're feeling, to process where they're at with something. These tend to be the things that people can start to change, either change their outlook on something or change a habit.
Why do you think blokes don't come and talk to you that quickly? I mean, because they don't.
Well, it's an interesting point. The more and more I've come into contact with people, the less and less I'm inclined to agree that the gender differences are quite so stark as they're made out to be, actually.
The stats are there, aren't they?
You can do a lot with stats.
You can.
But it's certainly true that a lot of men...
They say that.
And that's very distressing and is noteworthy in itself, regardless of what the female stats are. But the question is one of why don't people talk in general? Is that obviously by the time they've gotten to you, Wes, they've already had to jump through a few hoops of realising that they needed help and realising they needed to talk to someone.
I suppose what I will say is that far more men are coerced into coming than women are. There's one thing. So I've had a lot of partners ring up. If we're talking heterosexual couple, I'll have the woman ring up about the man.
Mm.
So, I mean, that has happened a few times. If I think about clients that I've seen over the years, though, it is a pretty even mix of men and women. Perhaps I should look more closely at that and try and figure out what some differences are. But we are men. What are your experiences of reaching out for support and help? I mean, for a start, you went and did a show at the Edinburgh Fringe for
self-help. If an Edinburgh Fringe show isn't a cry for help,
it probably would have been easier just to ring and make an appointment with someone around the corner. But what motivated your choices?
I think we all like to feel as individuals, but I don't think necessarily what I do is any route for what anyone else should do. It's not the most sensible idea, but...
I suppose what I'm saying is I don't feel I can... Well, none of us can speak for everyone, can we? I could only bring in my own experiences.
Yeah, but if you had two things, you had your choice of going to see a professional or going to a show you've not written at Edinburgh, I'm pretty sure the advice of the first one would be better than the second.
Yeah.
But I guess as well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's whatever works for you.
Yes.
You
know? Yeah.
And the Edinburgh thing worked for me, and ongoing like this sort of podcast works for me, and doing the shows. But I actually, after the shows I do, I feel great after the shows. Mm-hmm. And some people think, how can you stand up there and say what you say for an hour and a half, and bear all, but I actually feel better after it. And it's just a talking thing. And whether that is where we talk afterwards and other people tell me about what they think and what they've been up to, and I think that's great as well. But that just comes back to the fact that I generally really like people, and I really like people talking. I think it's great, and so it makes me feel better.
So you kind of chose your treatment modality of going and doing it in performance, which is interesting. But how long did it take you to go and do that show from the point where you realised that you were not feeling great? So, like, the same point that everyone else would be at, I don't feel great, I need to go and access treatment. And for a lot of us, there's many years between I feel everything is going wrong and actually reaching out and accessing treatment. What I'm curious about is whether or not you could access going and doing a fringe show faster than someone else could get into CBT.
You probably could, yeah.
I think
the waiting list is ridiculous. You could probably get on for the Fringe next year before having a CBT session.
I did 6 shows at Edinburgh as well, and I think you can only get 6 on the NHS.
That's true. And you didn't have to fill in any bloody forms.
I did
have to fill a form in.
Okay. Then when you took it out to the street, it was less welcomed, wasn't it? So I suppose that's the equivalent of just wandering around the street talking about your problems.
It went down
people
really...
People are like, go and see someone.
It went down really badly. I didn't think everyone in Edinburgh for the Fringe had come for that, though. I sort of got that impression. Although, everyone on the street was doing either a show about Trump or about Brexit. That's what... There was me, and every other show was like that.
I mean, first, they're all screaming about their mental health, too. They're just using different words.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like you went fairly quickly from I don't feel great to coming up with an action plan, eccentric though it might be.
Yeah, but I think I've been going downhill for a number of years. Mm. And it just got to that... Well, it was certainly a breaking point, wasn't it?
Well, that's what I mean. That's what I'm gently interrogating about. I'm kind of curious, like, what was... What
Why are you being it? Gentle?
Gentle interrogation.
It's my job. Kind, but, yeah. I know, I'm stealing all Wes's jobs here.
No, go for it. Yeah, I'm learning a lot.
But I'm curious, because you went and did this thing, but we haven't really found what the turning point was. Yeah, what was it that enabled you to go, right, I'm going to go and book this show? Because for a lot of people, there's a turning point where they finally go and see the doctor, or where they go and see a doctor, and then for the 10th time they've been to see a doctor, finally go, oh yeah, and I cry in the shower every morning and I don't think that's good. But for a lot of people, it takes a long time to get to that point. And that's the bit that's difficult. It's the finally speaking up about it and saying, this is all broken and I need help. Mm. You kind of got to that point without having to talk to anyone else about it, other than the Edinburgh Fringe promoters who were bemused that you wanted to do a show that had no name or plan. But they were cool with that because it's the Edinburgh Fringe. Yes, so I feel like you cheated and skipped a step where you had to say, actually, bare your soul. I know you've subsequently gone and done that. Mm. So I'm just curious, I guess partly what the time was between you, how you realised that you needed to do something.
I don't think I did. I think I just thought, I feel like this would be a good idea, wouldn't it? And I don't know what the time scale is. I mean, what is that line? When does it become the point where you need to, when does you step over from from being sad to being very sad to being depressed? I mean, I don't even know when that is. I don't know when it started. Mm. And so I don't know what the answer is. I just know, thinking back about doing it and the whole application was, I was in no frame of mind whatsoever to book that show or to do it. And it wasn't a clear thought. It was just like stumbling into... That's a great idea. I'll just do that. And do you know what? No one could have stopped me from doing it.
I wonder if a lot of us also find that. What's a good idea? Bottle of wine. Mm. Taking a load of drugs. I wonder if you lux yourself into a good version of self-care that maybe not everyone does.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, you were looking for this turning point and you were wondering how conscious it all was, and I've just been thinking about perhaps another difference that I've noticed, speaking a little bit generally as well, but actually I would say that of the male clients that I've seen, it tends to be they wait the longest. Mm. So like, things are really bad.
Well, you need at least three things before you go to the doctor, right? Well, yeah, that's the classic one that I've heard endlessly from like the generation above.
Actually, my doctor always says just one issue per appointment.
That's enough.
Yeah, but that's my sense. I don't like to dive too deeply into these stereotypes, because I think it has become a bit of a stereotype. I think it's true and right that more attention needs to be given to men's mental health. I think that's true, and I'm not down on that. But what I am saying is actually, there's something just human about this. But actually, what I will say is that, generally speaking, men tend to wait longer. Mm. I would say that's one sense of mine.
Women are definitely more open to discussing. I mean, I had somebody at a show the other week, and she brought her husband along. I mean, she had brought him along. There's no getting away from that. That was just how it was. And she spoke to me first about his mental health issues.
Openly, oh, I like that. That's great.
Openly saying, he's been like this for years.
That was probably because she wanted you to sort him out for her benefit.
That's not something I provide, unfortunately.
My fella out.
And then he came over and said, hi, you're right. And he was a lot more understated about it. But I already knew the story before she'd come over, because she told me.
She showed you all of her notes.
Well, that's very convenient. It's nice to get all that information up front. Quite hard to
know what you're getting into. Yeah. Well, so the other thing I was going to say is that men perhaps tend to wait a bit longer. And actually, and this is where it becomes a bit more universal again, I think people will try other things first. People will try something else.
Like what?
Well, you just alluded to it, maybe there are unconscious ways that we try and cope. Throwing ourselves into the work, drinking that little bit more.
You can easily drink yourself to sleep.
Taking on a big, ridiculous, unachievable project. such as going to Edinburgh.
In what way was it unachievable?
People will try other things sometimes.
because there seems to be this reluctance to ask for support. Until you're in a social situation and you mention that you're a psychotherapist, then there's no reluctance. And, but then I think that's because maybe, you know, it's at a bar and so the drink has been involved. The point is that people, that there is this reluctance to speak about it, to speak out loud of it. That's why I was keen to be involved in this. Mm. You told me your whole motive was this should be spoken about more. I want to get it out there. And that's definitely needed. By the time people get to speaking to me and things unfold as you know, session by session, it becomes very apparent that that actually some of the things they've been trying to do to help how they're feeling have become part of the problem as well. You know, so.
I think you're right. It makes me think of accessibility. You know, the pub is a lot more accessible than cognitive behavioural therapy, and it's better known, much more widely available. And it's just there almost all the time. And I guess until therapy and counselling of some form becomes equally accessible, then it will always be harder to choose. It will always be harder to select that thing. Never mind the whole burying your soul bit and having to admit something. You don't have to admit anything if you're going to get a pint other than that you're at least 18. You know, that's an easy thing to go and achieve.
And I'm never asked to admit that either. You know, it's like, admit to me that you're at least 18. Okay, you can have a drink. But I think you're right. And you're a performer. Mm. You're a performer.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, it's all right. Just to clarify, I'm all about self-awareness and helping you find your identity. But I know I do a bit of performance, and I know for me that rehearsal each week is kind of a little bit of my own therapy.
Mm, for sure.
You know, it's something cathartic about it, being able to unwind, switch off.
There is.
There are lots of ways in which we can take care of ourselves.
It is. I mean, I think one of the things is talking to your friends, isn't it? That's the big thing. And that's to me is part of the problem is that I don't know what I've done to come up with this, but it doesn't seem as though people are still readily talk to their friends about mental health. That we've all got friends we can talk to, and I feel pretty fortunate. I've got a lot of friends who seem to be open and chatting, but I do hear lots of people who still do that whole thing, how are you? I'm fine, let's move on. Mm. And that's just still true. Do you know, I rushed home from a gig the other week and I was desperate to get in the pub before last orders for one pint and a packet of nuts, by the way.
Are you okay?
Yeah, no, it's fine. Yeah.
Did you have to admit you were 18?
They did ask for ID, but you know. So I was there at the bar and I had this bright blue suit on because I'd come straight from the gig. You were there, weren't we? And I stood at the bar and there's an old guy next to me. Not so old if he's listening, but he probably won't be. But he said, you're right, youth, you're right. I said, yeah, I just wanted to rush back from the gig I've been doing. And he says, oh, is that why you got a blue suit on? I said, yeah, also because I quite like it, you know, sort of thing. And he said...
those other clothes that you wear that you have.
And he said, what's the show about? And he said, oh, it was about mental health and about blokes. He said, oh, great, that's a really good idea. They should talk more, you know. He says, oh, nice suit you've got on there. He says, that's a good example, isn't it? I said, what's that? He said, 10 years ago, I couldn't have said that to you, mate. People would give me a weird eye if it said you got a nice suit on to another bloke, but now I feel all right about it.
Attitudes are changing. Yeah. How encouraging.
You're on something there. Just as you were talking about, you know, I'm fine and saying that to friends and stuff, and there's something around the roles we all fulfil in life as well, you know. I mean, I'm at work now, I'm okay, or I'm supposed to be strong and able, or I'm a parent, or I'm a psychotherapist, I should be okay, you know.
When's your time to cry?
We have roles, don't we? And I think just as certain roles are assigned to women, I think certain roles can be assigned to men as well. And I think that could have something to do with a reluctance to admit that I'm not okay, or to break convention and actually say, oh, you know, I'm feeling a bit crappy, actually.
I find there's a perverse politeness as well. I don't necessarily want to impose on someone else. I've always been fond of the slightly twisted saying, you know, a problem shared is a problem doubled. It's very hard to have a problem shared with you without taking on some part of that yourself, which is, you know, why, I guess, at least in theory, we have professionals who won't take that problem on as part of themselves, but inevitably will to some degree. Yeah, it always feels like if you're going to talk about your problems with someone else, you're in some way burdening them with it too.
Yeah, so I should at least pay them.
Yeah, absolutely. It is 20 quid for when I cry into your pint. Is that not okay? But I do wonder if there's a barrier there about not wanting to load other people down with what we might perceive to be our problems.
Well, so you talked about accessing CBT and then later on other types of counselling. Do you mind my asking how you got there? And I don't mean tell me all about your problems.
Well, it's a great bus.
I mean, you know, the decision to actually access counselling.
Yeah, it took a long time. It took 12 years of not sleeping. I've never really been very good at sleeping. That was always quite a good hint. And if you don't sleep, then you're...
Matt can tell you where you can get some sleeping tablets. Just
nice. I would like to know your GP. That sounds mint. Yeah, and sleep's one of the worst things that you can least do without. If you're not sleeping, then everything else will break down. No doubt about that.
I can agree with that. I have a 10-month-old.
Rough. It's number one in the CIA interrogation handbook, isn't it? Deprive them of sleep, you can get what you want out of them after 3 days. and you can see it in yourself, you know, as soon as you go more than a couple of days, only 3 or 4 hours sleep a night, you're already starting to lose it a little bit and things aren't stringing together. So I had a very long period of that and then a lot of drinking, not smoking weed to try and bounce everything out. Couldn't figure out why I didn't feel good. It took a very, very long time before it was so bad and it was so severely affecting my relationship with my partner. I wasn't communicating, wasn't sleeping, wasn't talking, wasn't doing anything right, that I finally went to see a doctor. And even then, it was the third time going to see the doctor before I actually said, oh yeah, it's not just the asthma. And also, I'm not sleeping. I feel horrible all the time. I would happily kill myself and everybody else that I know. And I suspect that's not right. You know, I'm getting the feeling this isn't how other people feel all of the time. Yeah, maybe some of the time, but not all of the time.
And then the doctor said, sorry, your 7 minutes is up.
It's like I said, one thing, and you've had that.
You're kind of proving what we were just talking about there, though, of waiting until it got really, really, really bad.
Yeah, it did.
Trying other things first, you know.
Yep. I went through a whole series of things that aren't as good treatment as CBT. You know, booze and drugs are not as good. They do some things really well. They don't fix your brain very nicely. They don't help you pick up the piece of your life at all.
Was it helpful?
Well, the drinking.
No, the cannabis.
It got me to sleep.
The CBT and the counselling.
Yeah, it was. The CBT was weird. It was cognitive behavioural therapy, so it's a lot of talking, being forced to think about what you're doing and to think about... Well, I'll probably mangle an explanation of what CBT is, but it's that you can't change the world around you, but you can change how you feel about the things that happen to you to a certain extent. You can adjust your attitudes and consider whether or not you're responding in a way that actually fits with what's going on around you. And I did find that useful. It didn't necessarily change the way that I thought, but it gave me some options that if I was like, oh, I feel really sad. Is there a good reason for this? Or am I just feeling sad and then indulging in it rather than trying to dig my way back out? And it gave me the idea that you can analyse how you feel rather than just accept it as a thing, as a sort of monolith of grief or sadness or rage, because you can't get through that. There's no way to deal with it. There's no way to use it.
I mean, people will have different opinions about how effective CBT is or isn't, and other forms of counselling as well, but ultimately it sounds like what you're saying is it gave you some kind of power over your experience.
It gave me some perspective and some tools.
Yeah.
That sometimes, you know, blunt against that monolith of rage or whatever, but yeah, they're still there. And yeah, you can still recognise that there are tools that can be used. Even if I can't access those tools, I'm still aware that there is a toolkit of possible tools. Even if I feel really, really low and you can't see a way forwards, I still know that there are things there, even if I can't reach them right now. You know, things will change. Things will get better at some point.
Did talking to friends have any effect on compared to that?
I didn't want to.
I was just going to say, I didn't hear you mention that you did. Yeah.
No, I didn't really want to. There are a few friends who I was going to were like, yeah, you're probably not well. That's not good. Maybe you should go and get some help. And it took, even with that prompting of people that I trust deeply, that's still a very big barrier to get over, that barrier of actually accessing help. That was really difficult to do, very hard to do.
Did you find talking to friends about the actual problem helps? Or do you?
Yeah, I think it did a bit, but it wasn't enough, because what I was getting was, you know, sympathy, some degree of empathy. I was going, ooh, that's really bad. I cannot help you get through this next bit. You know, there is a next bit where you need to go and get some more help.
The number one thing I hear from clients is that it's more problematic talking to friends and family. I hear that quite a lot. Yeah, which
Well, because they ask stupid questions.
Well, maybe someone doesn't know what to say. Maybe someone doesn't know how to respond.
That's what I meant politely.
Yeah, well, yeah. Or they're there, or they'll just clam up. You know. So I do hear that kind of thing a lot. And I think, again, there's something in the power of speaking to someone that just isn't connected to your life, you know, that is impartial, independent.
One of the worst things I've found about talking to friends is that sometimes the I have an expectation of how they're going to answer. And when it doesn't hit that, and I've got no right to expect them to do that, but when it doesn't hit that, it's quite depressing.
That makes sense, because you're looking for like the perfect response that obviously they have no reason to know. There's no reason why they should know how you need them to respond, and it's not necessarily their role.
I'm sure there are some friends out there that might say, "Well, what is it you need?" But actually, a lot of friends might try and give you what they think you need, or what they give you isn't what you need, and so yeah. And you mentioned the barrier earlier of not wanting to put something on people, you know. It seems. For people, there are a lot of reasons why it's either unhelpful to speak to friends or family, or they're unwilling to speak to friends or family.
I think you can find the right person, though.
Part of the problem, isn't it, really? You know, it just locks everything back underground again, potentially.
I think if you can find the right person, as well as a cine professional, talking to some friends is
I think so.
It's helped me.
Towards the end of a process...
They're learning with us, but it's helped me, you know.
Yeah. but it's both sides. One is the individual being able to seek help and do that. But there's also other people being able to actually help. A lot of people they're not interested to help. You know, someone might tell me their problems. I'm like, literally nothing I can do. It's the dude you meet in the street who is in tears, and you're like, are you okay? You know, plainly you're not. You know, the degree to which you can practically assist. Is potentially limited. You might be able to help them get to somewhere, but what are you supposed to do? And I'm not sure if we've given. It sounds kind of trite, but like signposting tools to kids. You know, if your friend is like this, maybe refer them to this. You know, we don't have a common vernacular or system for if one of your friends is in trouble, what do you do with them? You know, what can you practically do other than give them a hug? Because that's not always enough.
Towards the end of a process with someone, sometimes I might get them to think about the different kinds of support that they have out there. It's not realistic to think that someone could access counselling and seek someone professional every time there's a problem, is it? Either because you go through the NHS and you have to wait for a long, long time, or your alternative is to go private and that costs money, unfortunately. So it's useful if someone is in a good place to get them to think about the future and going forwards. What have I learned? What do I see differently? What tools or skills do I have? What might I do if I come across a similar kind of thing again? To get someone to think about the different kinds of support that they have available. And I suppose if we all sit and think about the friends and family, maybe we'd go to one person for practical advice. We'd go to another person because we know they'll just listen. They're not going to try and fix it. We might go to another person because they're not going to tell us what we should do. You know, the reality is we have different people that can offer different types of support, and sometimes just figuring that out for yourself is useful.
That makes a lot of sense. I wonder if we could prep people better for that. You know, we did loads of like personal social education stuff at school.
Yeah,
which is all about, you know, don't take drugs.
Yeah, well, maybe, when I worked in schools before I trained as a therapist, that's what I did, yeah.
Yeah, but there was no
and
mental
it tends
health
to be
stuff.
Just kind of fixed stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but there was none of that. There was none of that, you know, what do you do if someone comes to you needing help?
Well, there's the flip side of it. So getting a person to think about the different kinds of support they have around them. But the other side of it is letting people know that you don't have to do something magical and professional if a friend comes to you and in trouble, you know. Maybe you just need to be there. Maybe you just need to be able to listen and just give them a hug. I think sometimes it can be kind of, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this. The reality is maybe...
It's a bit like that death conversation, isn't it? You know, you tell someone's close to dying, the reaction to people, even the people you're really
sorry
close to.
Sorry to hear that, sorry for your loss.
And they just want to run away as quick as possible.
I'm here for you if you need, you know, you get all these...
I find it an interesting kind of like thing. You say, you should... listen to somebody telling you about their problem.
Well, there's no should, but
I know, definitely, but So what do you find yourself if you become that friend in the friend group where everybody starts unloading onto because they have that kind of personality that kind of makes them feel
you're
like,
the go-to guy.
Yeah, kind
of that's
like
really hard.
Ghoster, and I find that kind of interesting of definitely of saying, okay, you need to talk to your friends to get help. But I also feel like there's kind of like a responsibility of understanding that it affects your friend's mental health as much as it does yours.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
You have off time from seeing patients. So I feel like there's a kind of like a two sort of edge. Kind of like there's an edge.
Yeah, a double-edged sword.
Yeah, definitely.
I want to be here for you and I'm here to listen. But actually, yeah, there's only so much I can do and this stuff affects me and is distressing for me to hear as well,
of course.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the point is that the more conversations we can have with people around us, maybe we take away all these expectations, yeah? Maybe I can say, actually, Matt, the next time I come and speak to you, you know, you don't have to do anything in particular. Maybe I just want to vent a little bit.
Mm.
And maybe, you know, I could say, oh, you know, Nick, you're always welcome to come and speak to me, but if it's so bad, maybe we should help you look for professional support, you know? I think you're right. Well, but I think the other thing about all of this is responsibility. I think that's a really important word for all of this, really. Whose responsibility is it to do what and when? And we all have responsibility for ourselves, don't we?
Do you know, I think we're going to end soon. But we should try and end on a positive note, I think, which it's all been pretty positive. But I do think when it comes back to the whole suicide thing, and you talk to some people, the thing that I always try to remember when I'm talking to people, and I try to remember myself when I felt like that, is it how temporary it is. And I think that's the trick with friends, is to realise that you're in a frame of mind that isn't absolutely how you feel, really.
Yeah, we talked earlier about mental health, having mental health and having physical health, and just as your physical health fluctuates and you can break your leg and it will heal. Yeah, I think you're right. These feelings, or these overwhelming feelings of anxiety, this overwhelming feeling of depression, or this loss that I feel, or this problem that I'm having, yeah, it doesn't have to be permanent.
Mm.
It isn't permanent. Yeah, I think that's an important point. And sometimes just helping a person see that or realise
that. Well, there's a guy that came to the show in Lincoln, and he was with his friend. His friend had brought him, both of them have been through mental health issues. He said he felt like he's been through it, you know, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but he seemed like in a really good place and his friend wasn't. And he said to me that one of the things that made him feel good about the situation was that his friend had been through it and he was all right. And even though he can't see it himself, he could see it in his friend and thought, do you know what, there is half a chance I might get through this.
Instilling hope.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need those positive examples that people have survived it and do survive.
And that's why I think this normalising stuff, you know, is probably related to that. Actually, yeah, you know, it's okay to feel this way. I'm a human being. I think it's part of the human conditioning or something. It's the human condition to... We are almost designed to suffer at some point.
Thank you, God.
I know you wanted to finish on a positive note.
No, thank you, Wes. I feel great now.
That's okay.
Yeah. Should we come up with last thoughts then? Let's I'm not actually prepared anything, and I know you two haven't either.
I think it just reminds me of how different people are, but how very much we're the same. And the conversation about mental health is very much about realising that whatever mental health problems are discussed are held in common by very many people, including most people that you know and most of us ourselves. And we just need to be more open to recognising that, and that will enable us to talk about it more easily.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And it's almost my job is to kind of talk myself out of business. That's what I would hope for. Well, absolutely, yeah. So just as a person is leaving and they're feeling really positive, I sometimes will remind them and just say, don't forget that you had that traumatic experience and that it affected you deeply.
and that I have an opening next week.
So, yeah, do you write on the back of your business card?
Yeah. Yeah. It'll all be fine until it's not. That kind of thing. No,
just upside down. Smiley face, yeah.
No, but yeah. No, I agree with what you said.
Which of us is the therapist?
I just think the more we can normalise this, you know, to some extent, I'm not really bothered about the language I use. It's just that we're all having a conversation about this. And the same goes for, you know, whether we call it anxiety or whether we call it depression or whatever we call it. The point is, we just all need to be speaking about this. You talked about going performing at Edinburgh. We talked about ways in which we can try and cope. And yeah, some things aren't helpful, like the things that bury and cover over tend not to be helpful. And the things that tend to be helpful tend to be those things that are pointing outwards, you know, getting something out, expressing something, yeah. Whether that's talking to friends, whether it's writing a song, or whether it's taking a step to go and speak to a professional.
I'm preempting things this year. I've booked into Edinburgh already.
Have you? So you're expecting to have a rubbish year.
Yeah, but
still no plan.
And, I think I'll come with you.
And the problem I've got is I feel all right. So
do you want to see me next week?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, here's Wes's card.
Are we done? Till next time.
Unless you have any final thoughts or reflections. Yeah.
No, I think you two have covered it. I don't think there's any final thoughts. Let's keep those for next time and keep it going, which is exactly how we should with conversations.
Yeah, sounds good.
Brilliant. All right.
If you've been affected by anything that we've talked about tonight, that's cool. We were kind of hoping you would be. If you haven't been affected by anything tonight, then that's great too. You're probably fine. Of course, if you say you're fine, there's a good chance you aren't. So you might also have been affected. And if you've been affected before, you probably will be again. Please talk to someone. It can get better, and together we can survive. We are what we overcome. And these poor